Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Susan Wilson. As an increasing number of children face the serious disease of childhood obesity, we take a look at local media campaigns and research efforts that work to promote healthier eating habits. And we'll talk about new research and what it tells us about the issue of self-control and how advertising affects obese children and others, I would imagine. Our guests today are Dr. Amanda Bruce, assistant professor at the BRAIN lab at UMKC. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning.
And also Dr. Jennifer Lundgren, associate professor and chair of the Eating, Sleep, and Circadian Rhythm Research Lab, long name, at UMKC. Welcome to Central Standard as well. So, in a nutshell, there's been a lot of talk, a lot of efforts in the area of childhood obesity. I know all around the city there are various initiatives aimed at this issue. And, of course, even our First Lady is on the bandwagon. Are we impacting the growing numbers of children who are overweight?
I'll let Amanda speak to that first. She has a lot of more experience with childhood obesity.
I think it's a good question, and you're right that there has been a lot of increasing attention to the issue of childhood obesity, not only in Kansas City, but in the nation in general. And in terms of the prevalence of childhood obesity, we're about at a third of our children are either obese or overweight. And so the prevalence in the past several decades has increased dramatically.
And how about for adults?
For adults, it's been about 30% are obese, and when you include overweight and obese. So I'm not sure if everyone knows what that means. So the medical definition of that is it's a height-weight ratio called the body mass. I think a lot of people have heard of the body mass but don't necessarily know what body mass index is. So having a body mass index of 30 or above is medically obese, and 25 to 29.9 is overweight. So when you include both overweight and obese, it's about two-thirds of the U.S. population right now is overweight or obese, which it's been steadily increasing. I've seen different reports that it is leveling off some, but I still think, in general, that's probably a pretty good estimate.
Now, speaking of the body mass index, I know some of your research discusses how this may impact the ability to lose weight. Can you talk about that a little bit in terms of the relationship between body mass index and weight loss issues?
Yeah, I'm happy to speak to that a little bit because I've done a lot of work with adults who are trying to lose weight. In general, I think that the clinical research literature would suggest that most people can successfully lose about 10% of their baseline body weight over about a 5 to 6 month period. And so when I work with people, I encourage them to set some shorter term goals that are around that 10% mark, and then some longer term longer lifestyle goals. So over the next 3 to 5 years, what do you need to continue to do to maintain that weight loss and to see more weight loss? And what we find is that as people lose weight, there are physiological changes and psychological changes that do make it a little bit more difficult to continue to lose weight. For one, as you weigh less, you're not burning as many calories. Imagine if you strapped some weights onto you when you are at rest and when you're exercising, you'll actually burn more calories than if you take those off. So if you're losing body fat over time, you will lose or be burning fewer calories at rest and during exercise. So that's one of the physiological factors. And then the psychological factors is people find after about 6 months, they've made a lot of changes to their dietary patterns. Maybe they've decided that for lunch they have their lower calorie bread and cheese and meat, and then they're tired of it. Mm-hmm. It gets very boring. Yeah. And so those choices that in the short term they were able to make are harder to maintain in the long run. The other thing, I've worked with a lot of people who are trying to lose weight, and they'll say, well, I've done really well. I'm going to give myself this treat. And then that's okay if it's in a controlled manner, but then sometimes that can trigger a bit of a relapse.
The treating time goes on a little too long. I think I've experienced that. So, Dr. Bruce, now you've done some specific research on issues of how media impacts even neuroscience and increasing the propensity to overeat, as well as other issues around impulsivity and self-control. Can you talk a little bit about your research?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So some of the research that I've done has been with children, and specifically looking at differences between obese and healthy weight children. And starting when I was a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Kansas Medical Center at the Hoagland Brain Imaging Center, we were interested, along with Carrie Savage's group, to look at how the brain responds to food cues. And we published a study showing that obese children, their brains respond differently to images of food than healthy weight children's brains do.
How so?
Good question. So we look at regions of the brain that are involved in motivation and reward, and also decision-making and self-control. And so these, if you break it down in a very simple way, obese children's brains show hyperactivation, so more activation to these images of food than healthy weight kids do in their brains. So as an extension of that, I was curious to see if this, if these findings would apply to food marketing. And so what we did next, and this is a study we just published, we looked at brain responses of obese children and compared them to brain responses of healthy weight children when they were looking at food logos. So very common symbols like the McDonald's arches, KFC. And we wanted to see if there were differences in how obese children's brains and healthy weight children's brains responded to these images. What we found is that, contrary to what we thought we would see obese children's brains light up more in reward areas. But that wasn't the case. All the kids, regardless of weight status, their brains lit up to these logos. These logos are rewarding. They're enjoyable.
Associated with high-calorie, good-tasting food.
Exactly. They're very rewarding. We saw that for the non-food logos as well, and that's a point that I should make. So, logos such as Nike or PlayStation, the children's brains were responding favorably to those logos as well. So they were lighting up in areas related to pleasure and reward centers. What we did see, probably the most provocative finding, was that the healthy weight children, their brain showed more activation in a region that's associated with self-control. So when we directly compared these healthy weight kids' brain activations to the obese children's brain activations, healthy weight kids' brains, when they're looking at food logos, are showing more activation in regions associated with self-control.
Now, do we know why that is? Is that because children who are obese, somehow that changes their brain, or they were predisposed to be more susceptible to overeating in the first place?
That's a fantastic question. We don't have enough data to answer that question yet, but that's basically the next step. You know, is this a chicken and egg issue? You know, are these differences present from very early in life, or are these brain activation differences that we see a consequence of adding weight over time?
So, Dr. Lundgren, some of your work has involved sleep, and I think most people don't even think about sleep in terms of how it relates to being overweight or gaining weight.
Absolutely. It's really kind of an exciting new area. I think for the first time, people are starting to recognize the overall health impact of both sleep and circadian rhythm. And, you know, what happens when people for a long period of time, for example, work at an alternate shift where they work overnight, and what impact does that have on them, both their mental and their physical health? And I think the sleep piece is important both for the adults and for the children. So there have been a lot of studies that have showed that people who get fewer hours of sleep per night compared to those, so usually 5 hours or less per night, are more likely to gain weight over time or to be overweight than people who get, 7 to 9 hours of sleep. I became interested in sleep because I study something called night eating syndrome, which is where people either eat 25% or more of their total daily food intake after the evening meal, or, and this occurs with it as well, they go to sleep and then wake up in the middle of the night and eat. And this affects about 10 to 15% of overweight and obese adults. It's very rare among children, although we have a longitudinal study right now in Canada where we're following kids. We are getting ready to follow them for the third round of data collection, started when they were 8 to 10 years old. And a few of them did wake up at night and eat. So we're also interested in how this runs in families. So, definitely a sleep, what is that? What's the relationship there? Some people suggest that sleep is related to obesity and weight gain through physiological changes in the way that one metabolizes food, for example. Other people have suggested that it's through what they call non-homeostatic mechanisms, which basically is a fancy word for saying, are there psychological or social reasons? So if you are not getting good sleep, are you less likely to engage in physical activity, or are you less likely to eat in the home and more likely to eat fast food because you are tired.
You're tired.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we actually, with some collaborators at University of Kansas Medical Center and the Hoagland Brain Imaging Center, just completed data collection on a brain imaging study where we were looking at decision making. The task we were using is people choose between smaller amounts of money now or larger amounts of money later. It's to look at one's ability to delay, in that case, financial gratification. And we were looking at people who were poor sleepers and better quality sleepers. We're just now starting to analyze the data, but it does look as if people who have more sleep problems, they wake up more in the middle of the night, actually have less brain activation during some of these tasks in areas associated with control, behavioral and cognitive control. So it might be affecting brain physiology as well. But again, which comes first? It's hard to tell.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Susan Wilson, and today we're talking about childhood obesity and being overweight with KU's Amanda Bruce and Jennifer Lundgren, chair of Eating, Sleep, and Circadian Rhythm Research Lab. Kansas City, what's been your experience with this topic? What works in helping you delay the impulse to resist great-tasting but fattening food? Tell us your thoughts by calling 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Or post your comments on Facebook or Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Now, one of the at least myths that you hear is, I should eat all of my more fattening and heavy meals earlier in the day. Because I can burn it off. So do you really gain more fat from food when you eat it late in the day?
I don't know that you gain more fat. It's going to depend on what specifically you're eating. I do think I actually just came across a paper that I was reading today about how the body was probably designed so that we do tend to eat more in the evening to prepare for this long fast that we have while we're sleeping. And so there might be some reasons, perhaps evolutionary or just based on our design, why we do tend to eat more later in the day than in the morning. Independent of what I mentioned I studied before, people who eat unusually larger amounts of food in the night. Culture also plays a role in this. I've spent a little bit of time sharing some of my work. I was in Cyprus a couple of years ago, and where it's common to eat, the largest meal of the day at 10 p.m. So I think that it varies a little bit regionally and culturally.
And I think if I can just add to that, what it ultimately comes down to is an energy balance issue, mm-hmm. right? So if your energy intake in the form of food and calories you know, is in excess of your energy expenditure with your physical activity, you know, chronically, then you will gain weight. Yeah. So.
Although I would add, I think what's interesting from the circadian rhythm literature is that we are finding when, and especially in animal models, when they eat the opposite time. So for, in rodents, for example, they're up at night and sleep during the day. When they're put on opposite schedules, even if they're eating the same amount of calories, they do gain more weight. Mm. But we just haven't had the ability to study that in humans as much as these animal models. So I think it's an interesting scientific question.
So, you know, there's a lot of research going on. Of course, when you go to the bookstore, there's a different diet every week. So I guess what I'd like to ask is, so how do we generalize some of the findings from research into practical advice for people? What is there to be taken away from some of the emerging research findings?
It's an excellent question. You're right when you point out, you know, there's a different diet, you know, seemingly all the time. And
even one on blood type.
Right. Yes, I read about that one recently, too. I think what we can say is that we're fairly good, and people in general are able to lose weight in the short term, right? Most diets really, and they've done studies that compare, for example, Atkins diet to South Beach diet, for example. And diets in general are effective. What's the trick in this is helping people maintain the weight loss in the long term. And that's very difficult.
Yeah, I would say it's a shift from thinking of it as a diet to a long-term lifestyle change where you really are going up against so many factors such as the marketing. There was a piece in the New York Times a month or two ago just about the science of food creation and the way that companies create food so that the taste, the smell, the texture is perfect. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So that you're most likely to buy it. And I think a lot of people don't even realize that their food is designed so that you will buy it.
And Michael Moss wrote a book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, mm-hmm. that speaks to that exact issue.
Well, you know, it's funny because we have a caller right now that has a question about that. I want to welcome to the show Bertie from KCMO.
Yeah,
and you have a question.
I've noticed because I grew up in a time when you didn't eat snack foods during the Depression. And you ate real food. So I don't use coupons because they're all for food products, not plain foods. And my question is there a problem with the way food is marketed, food products, or the way it is, as you just said, especially designed to trigger people's appetites with the combination of sweet, fat, and starch? So how much has that contributed to obesity in this country?
That's a very good question.
It's an excellent question, and it's a pretty hot topic right now, actually. You know, there are these food movements that, you know, promote the idea of local foods and eating more, quote-unquote, natural foods or more organic foods and less of the very processed, exactly what you mentioned, these food products that basically, in some sense of the word, are just combination of salt, sugar, and fat in varying quantities that, you know, companies have found to be very pleasurable to people. And companies will produce what people will buy. And people want food that tastes good. You know, we're programmed, you know, our physiology is such that we are driven toward these calorically dense foods. And so I think it's an excellent question how much the food industry or food marketing is to blame for this. It's a pretty controversial topic right now.
Yeah, and I think what complicates it is that there are so many factors. I think that there, people are doing more now and have less time to be home preparing foods, growing foods. Even, you know, something that's complicated, there's a term called epigenetics that has shown that even what your grandmother ate could affect your body composition and the foods that you like.
How so?
It
That's very interesting.
Yeah. So there, the idea is that there is a genome on top of the genome. The genes can be turned on and off. And so what you're exposed to in utero by something, for example, your mother ate, or what your mother may have been exposed to by something her mother ate, could turn your genes on or off. Now, that, of course, means they're going to interact differently with your other genes and your environment. So, again, a lot of this is still in the animal model stage, but there have been some really interesting studies showing how obesity develops in mice differently based on mother mice who were genetically identical, but fed different chow. And that their offspring ended up being different. And it was because of the way this epigenome.
You know, I talk to a lot of people with children, and I have grandchildren myself. And I know there's many parents out here now who really are on the healthy eating train, and they try to take out snack foods. But, I mean, to this last caller's point, children who watch cartoons know about the sugary cereals and the other unhealthy foods. And then they go to school, and, you know, our school cafeterias are getting better, but they're not there yet either. Mm-hmm. So what advice do you give parents who are really trying to impact this social marketing food availability issue?
Yeah, parents have a really crucial role to play in this. And, you know, exactly what you mentioned, Susan, is that if parents can be aware of what their kids are exposed to, try and limit screen time. That's very important. I mean, advertising is ubiquitous. We see it everywhere, and it's, you know, it's cross-product as well. So it's not just, you know, food being advertised for food's sake, but, you know, Disney characters are put on fruit snacks. Boxes, for example, and, you know, there's this cross-marketing that occurs. And so it behooves parents really to be very vigilant about what their kids are exposed to and try and help develop in their children a sense of awareness about, you know, what advertisers are trying to do, what they're trying to get them to buy, and help their kids make good decisions about those.
And I would add, you know, this is just from my own personal experience having a 3.5-year-old. It also comes from family. You know, my mother-in-law knows that my son loves car gummies because he loves the movie Cars. And we try to limit those. And we were visiting her a couple weeks ago, and she said, "Oh, they were on sale. I bought you 4 boxes." And I thought, no. And so we hid them, you know, and some of them we ended up giving away so that he couldn't eat them, because if they're around, it's going to be a constant battle. Mm-hmm. So just saying no and being comfortable saying no.
Well, speaking of battle, it seems like you have to fight the battle on the other end, too, in terms of equipping people and children with strategies. So are there examples of cognitive and self-control strategies that people can be taught to resist some of these temptations that are all around them?
You've hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is what researchers are trying to figure out right now is, can we improve self-control? Can we improve decision-making in not only children, but adults as well? I mean, all of us have made bad decisions, and really helping people to have better strategies to approach decisions is key. In regards to eating, some of the strategies that they've had children look at are, you know, when faced with an appetizing food, to try and think of the attributes of that food that are concrete, such as the shape or, you know, the description, the color, instead of, oh, think of the taste and how delicious that would be if I ate it.
Yeah. And I think with adults, there are a lot of different strategies that we use. And one is just to set a regular eating schedule. I think a lot of people end up, you know, I'm going to really limit what I take in because I'm going to start this diet today, or I'm going to stick to my diet today. They end up making themselves hungrier and set themselves up for overeating later. And the other things that we do are helping people to appreciate how food becomes conditioned with people and emotions and experiences and places. So teaching people to disconnect those relationships. So in, you know, a very practical strategy, we will have people do, you know, when they eat, you eat at the kitchen table and only eat. So, yeah.
So are we somewhat to blame as a society because there is a tremendous stigma to being obese? And, you know, if I'm obese and there's a stigma, does that just make me want to overeat more because I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel? And what can we do about that aspect?
Well, I can't speak to whether or not it makes someone want to overeat more, but I do think that it probably makes people more uncomfortable wanting to, you know, engage in physical activity, for example. I think we need to keep in mind that some of our marketing and our public health messages, there are ways to get people to make healthy behavior change without stigmatizing obesity. And we need to be very aware of when our message might be inadvertently stigmatizing obesity.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, Jenny raises a great point, you know, with these behavioral interventions and improving self-control, that is a key piece to this. And the other question I think that we have to answer and to think about very carefully is, you know, are there policies and, you know, how ethical is it to market very unhealthy foods to children?
Well, I'd like to thank our guest today, Dr. Amanda Bruce, Assistant Professor for the Brain Lab at UMKC, that's BRAIN, and Dr. Jennifer Lundgren, Associate Professor and Chair of the Eating, Sleep, and Circadian Rhythm Research Lab at UMKC. You can subscribe to our podcast and hear this conversation again or access any of our previous shows from Central Standard on the page at kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow for the Movie Critics as they look at the newest releases and explore the question of what films should be and should not have been made into sequels. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Claire McInerney and Ross Steinmetz-Stein. Again, thank you, Dr. Bruce and Dr. Lundgren. Up to Date is next with the Ethics Professor. For KCUR Central Standard, I'm Susan Wilson. And keep on listening.